You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
The WHO warns that COVID-19 is nowhere near over. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken makes some significant choices for his first South American trip. And why did New Zealand negotiate special protection for a dance in its new free trade deal with the UK? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Daniela Peled, will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have Henry Reese Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Professor in International Law and International Affairs at Birkbeck College, and by Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Hello to you both.
Hey.
Daniela, you have just been to Sarajevo. How was that?
I have. It was very fun, as ever. Sarajevo is a lovely city.
It is. I have not been, it occurs to me now, though, since I went there for a wedding in about 2003 or something. Well, it must be more recent than that. Anyway.
It's interesting. I mean, we're going to be talking about the pandemic shortly, and it's interesting to see how they've handled it. As a Bosnian colleague of mine told me that the approach has been similar to that during the siege, is that pretend that everything is fine and carry on as normal, which it was probably quite good for surviving the longest siege in modern history, but perhaps not so good for pandemic related.
Did you get any interesting t-shirts? Remember, they have some very interesting ones.
They have the full panoply of their t-shirt game is very, very strong.
It is very strong. On the subject of which, leaping seamlessly to our other guest, Oscar, you are wearing a t-shirt with writing on it. It says post-punk.
What can I say? I'm still drumming. I'm still dreaming. I might join Duran Duran at some point, or rather The Clash.
I don't know if either of those would be necessarily considered post-punk, would they? I mean, The Clash were actual punk, Duran Duran,
yeah,
your new romantic.
They kept going.
We are in terrible danger of deviating from the point here, I fear, which we should probably return to, because the point is that those fun spongers and buzz killers at the World Health Organization have warned that the COVID-19 pandemic will last deep into 2022, as if the novelty hadn't long since worn off. The WHO notes, not without reason, that while many rich countries have done pretty well with vaccinations, this isn't over for any of us until it's over for all of us. And as things stand, way too many poorer countries are languishing unvaccinated. Less than 5% of all Africans, for example, are fully vaccinated. Oscar, obviously a vast, if not grotesque, disparity there, but is anybody, specifically the rich countries with the wherewithal to make a difference here, likely to listen to the WHO about this at this point?
Well, that's indeed the problem, as you pointed out, Andrew. Safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines were developed in record time, but the problem is the virus is moving faster than the global distribution of vaccines. And in fact, the vast majority have been administered in high and upper middle income countries, mostly in 10 countries alone. So consider that 10 countries out of 190 plus. Of course, the implication is quite clear. To stop the pandemic, we need to vaccinate some 40% of people in every country by the end of 2021 and at least 70% by the first half of 2022. It doesn't take a genius to say that's not going to happen.
Daniela, there was some vague, possibly vainglorious hope early on in the pandemic that faced with what is, you know, a global problem, we might think in terms of a global solution. But was it always inevitable, do you think, that nation states would end up approaching this nationally rather than globally, i.e. we'll look after ourselves, and if we can look after anybody else, well, then fine, we'll think about it, but it's not really a priority?
Well, I mean, think about it in terms of domestic politics. However many, well, whatever supply of vaccine, you need to deliver the first dose to your population, then the second dose, and now already we're moving on to booster shots. So imagine in terms of domestic politics, I mean, the theory is all very well saying, oh, no one is safe until everyone's safe. But saying, right, we're going to prioritise aid, vaccine efforts in the developing world, it doesn't really go down very well. And it's a kind of theoretical point. And also, it hasn't been really at any point any sort of a happy, clappy, or let's all get along and let's cooperate effort, because there's been massive competition between Russia developing a vaccine, China developing a vaccine, each side promoting their own vaccines, and masses of disinformation about the other side, the other vaccines. And that's the other issue as well. You know, supply is one thing, but the vaccine disinformation and mistrust for all kinds of reasons is incredibly strong in the developing world, let alone the infrastructure of delivering vaccines. So I think, I agree with Oscar. It's really, really not looking good.
Oscar, there is one obvious consequence of what we can probably think of as vaccine inequality, which is that lots more people in the unvaccinated countries will get sick, many of them seriously ill, and many of them will die. That's the obvious issue here. But what are the ramifications of vaccine inequality beyond that? Is this going to be one of those things, you know, just along the lines that I have always argued, as have many others, that there is a massive self-interest argument for foreign aid. And you know, even if you don't care about being generous to other countries, it actually ends up working out pretty well for your own country in the long run. So even if you don't care about anybody else, you should do that because it's good for you. Does the same thinking apply to vaccines?
Totally. This, in fact, has very little to do with, you know, people's conscience or good intentions or even international solidarity. Actually, the self-interest argument does apply here, because the obvious consequence of, as you pointed out, people not getting vaccinated is that the virus will mutate. And as soon as it mutates and people travel, and people will continue to travel and move around, we will see more variants, newer variants coming back here. And as soon as that happens, the defense wall, which is already crumbling in countries such as the United Kingdom, if we are to believe what the scientists are telling us, will crumble very soon. So that there is a self-interest issue there, which is what makes this not a theoretical problem. I might add that in terms of who is producing the vaccine and which developing countries do have the possibility and the structure to do so, it is very interesting to look at the statistics in Latin America. Which one is the country with the most people vaccinated? Who do you think?
You invited me to take a guess. I'll take a wild slap at Colombia.
Cuba. No surprises there, actually. They do have the infrastructure. I think Colombia's pretty low in the ranking. I have the statistics here with me.
But vaccinated with which vaccine? And I know that Cuba's had all huge vaccine efforts to develop their own vaccine. I'm not sure about
that's precisely the point. You're not sure about, but that only means we cannot be sure about whether it is working or not, or whether it is working better than the ones here. We already know that we need boosters and so on and so forth. So at least in principle, we can say, at least in terms of the statistics and the numbers, they are vaccinating more people more quickly. And that has not been the case in other countries in Latin America. Again, what that means is, for all of us, the reality that the virus will continue to mutate, we will continue to see new variants. This is why the WHO is saying, look, we're no way near the end of this.
Daniela, moving from one insular, isolated island consecrated to a bizarre personality cult to another, i.e. this one, how concerned are you for what looms for the UK this winter? Because the government seems to be very much thinking very seriously about making all the same mistakes it did last year.
Yeah, I'm personally very concerned. Certainly in schools and secondary schools, the virus is just soaring in numbers, and people are double vaccinated. They're still getting pretty sick, and the stresses and strains on the NHS just seem to be bonkers. You know, a friend of mine was in A&E the other week, and it sounded apocalyptic, you know, constant announcements saying the wait to see a doctor will be 8 hours. This ward is about to collapse. I mean, really, you know, we're not functioning. We're just not functioning. And that, given the rest of the usual workload that you have in the winter season in the NHS. And I do think that, you know, small measures like wearing masks indoors and on public transport, which doesn't really cost us anything, and it actually should be really easy to promote through social pressure. And, you know, us British people are kind of obsessed with politeness and doing the right thing. Promulgating that could have, and I'm not a public health expert, but it seems to make just the perfect sense that that would make a difference. It makes a difference with flu. Would it make any difference with, it would make any difference with any respiratory illness.
Final thought on this, Daniela, and I am going to hold you answerable for this entire nation as the lone British person at this table. How did we get to a point in this country where we are actually waging a culture war over wearing masks during the pandemic of a respiratory infection? We have had today the Member of Parliament and cosplaying Woodhousian nitwit Jacob Rees-Mogg saying that Tories don't need to wear masks in the Commons. I'm not making this up. He said this out loud where people could hear him, as they have a convivial fraternal spirit.
Well, I am sure that PhDs will be written in the not too distant future about why exactly this is. Why in a country when two people bump into each other in the street, they both apologise, why you go on the tube and half the people are not wearing masks and looking around quite aggressively? Or maybe that's just my... Maybe that's what it looks like to me.
Or it's just the effect you have on your fellow commuters, Daniela. But let's now look at Latin America, which will hopefully be a more cheerful vista, portions of which have recently been playing host to US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. It was Blinken's first trip as Secretary of State to South America, and there wasn't much missing the subtext in his choice of countries. Ecuador and Colombia, two reasonably solid democracies, reasonably friendly to the United States. He did not, for example, find the time, as his predecessors from the previous administration might well have, to drop in on Brazil. Oscar, was Blinken trying to make a point about who gets to be friends with this White House?
I think this is a very interesting trip, more than it might appear. On the one hand, you have a paradox here. On the one hand, yes, they were trying to make the point. But also, it's an issue of where else can he go? Can he really go to Brazil with Mr. Bolsonaro there? Probably not. Not good looking. I mean, the guy is the Trump of the tropics, to put it mildly. So where else do I go? I go to Ecuador and Colombia, and I can reaffirm the friendship and, as you just pointed out, the firm democracy in these two countries, only that in both countries, both presidents are in real trouble. Lasso in Ecuador has just fallen 20 points in all the polls because of the revelations about where his money is from the Pandora Papers. And in fact, the Ecuadorian Congress has called him twice to appear before the General Assembly to spill the beans, as they say, or respond. And he has to. So far, he has been just avoiding them. But that's not going to go for long. And in fact, he has suggested he would be ready to dissolve Congress. So no surprise, Blinken goes there and says, first thing he says is, oh, you have to make sure that you maintain the constitutional order here, meaning you cannot just go and close it. But the Ecuadorian government has already declared a state of emergency, which is very complicated. And as for Iván Duque in Colombia, well, the question with him is there a bottom? Because he keeps falling and falling. And it does seem, according to every poll so far, that in the presidential elections next year, the only candidate that is still standing is the center-leftist one, Gustavo Petro. So actually, maybe Blinken is already, and the United States are already looking at the possibility that Colombia, the longtime ally of the United States, might change its tune. And that might explain why Blinken was so tough on Duque. I mean, really tough. Duque, if you see him on TV, he's having a very bad time. because Blinken pretty much asked him to account for it. It is safe to say,
isn't it, that Duque would have been rather happier if the last U.S. presidential election had gone the other way.
Well, that's the other thing. The Democrats know that Duque and the Uribistas were totally pro-Trump. In fact, they may have even inspired the very character. And so the first thing Blinken says to Duque is, you have to account for the people your government, he said in so many words, killed during the protests. So, and that's a very strange thing to say for a U.S. Such a high ranking U.S. officer. And he said so there in Colombia. Of course, there is also the issue of migration, which is sort of what was at the surface of this encounter.
Well, Daniela, related to migration is one of the other subjects they will have discussed or have definitely discussed, which is Venezuela. But is that something at this point that anybody thinks is a solvable problem, or is it just something you discuss at moments like this?
Well, I mean, it's the migrant crisis there is extremely acute. I mean, we've seen similar crises with refugees and so on in Europe and the Middle East, which is an area I'm more familiar with. But I was surprised to learn that the crisis is almost at the level of that of the Syrian exodus as well. The difference is though, and again, I learned about this recently, there's been much, much less focus on it, much, much less international support. I mean, there's been huge efforts made to ensure that the Middle East isn't destabilized further by the influx of Syrian refugees in countries that are already under stress and strain, but very little attention really when it comes to Latin America. And of course, America, North America, has got great interest in trying to stem this tide of migrants. I don't know, migrants, refugees. But it seems it's just a holding pattern, just trying to manage it rather than any idea of, you know, what would a solution look like? That's the question.
Just a final quick thought on this subject, Oscar. How concerned is the United States about putting on more of a show in South America as China takes more and more of an interest?
That's an interesting question, because to me it did seem as if the United States, who has been very focused elsewhere in the world, sort of look around and said, oops, something is really going on here. As I pointed out, two things. Number one, the fact that next year, after the elections, the political landscape of Latin America is very likely to look very, very, very different. I mean, it's very likely that Lula will win in Brazil, and so on. And I already spoke of Colombia. Number two, migration is not just Venezuela, it's Haiti. To link it up with COVID, of course, Haiti has the worst statistic of COVID vaccinations, 0.3 per 100 population, which is really bad. So people are really running for their lives. And they're arriving in Colombia and Ecuador, moving downwards and upwards. And of course, you know what that means. More migration pressure on the United States, for instance, becomes a political issue for the presidency. Because, of course, Trump is not going to allow that crisis to go to waste.
Oscar Guardiola-Rivera and Daniela Pellad, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We will have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marie Doha Besancenot is the brand and communication director of Allianz France. Marie Doha Besancenot, it's great to talk with you. How do ESG risks and opportunities play a part in Allianz investment and insurance?
Well, to be honest, insurance is not a high emissions industry. So the way we can have an impact is mainly through investments. So ESG principles guide the way we invest simply because we believe that companies that prioritize sustainability lead to better long-term outcomes. So one thing we do is we choose our asset managers based on their commitment to ESG principles, and we evaluate them continuously to ensure that they fully integrate these practices. Then, in a nutshell, there are three ways we can implement our ESG ambitions. The first way, very simply, is excluding what is bad for the planet and for humans. So we ban weapons, we ban sovereign bonds from countries violating human rights, and we ban coal-based business models. The second way where we can implement our ESG ambition is investing massively in what is good. So low-income housing or renewable energy, where Allianz Group invests close to 7 billion euros. And the third way we can act is influence the way other companies do business by providing incentive. We believe at Allianz that companies which ignore sustainability today run the risk of raising negative sentiment among their own customers, among their employees, and run the risk eventually of becoming a stranded asset. So every Allianz entity today engages in discussions with investee companies to increase their level of ESG integration and transparency. Concretely, that means we help them review their governance, see how they monitor the ESG risks, how detailed their ESG disclosure is, and so on.
Marie Doha-Besancenot, Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France, on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Mullett. Still with me are our guests, Daniela Peled and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. It is barely a year since Israel and the United Arab Emirates concluded the Abraham Accords, under which they shook hands, normalised diplomatic relations and exchanged ambassadors, reaching, therefore, the state of formality which exists between any number of nations which cannot stand each other but cannot be bothered maintaining a grudge. However, Israel and the UAE are clearly not content with the mutual exchange of formal telegrams on national holidays, etc. They're going to the moon together. Daniela, specifically, the UAE is now going to be in on the Bereshit 2 lunar mission, which Israel is due to launch in 2024. Is this exciting?
Well, you know, rockets and space. Like, how can that not be exciting?
I think it's pretty exciting.
It's very exciting. I mean, Bereshit 1, named after the first word of the Bible in Hebrew, in the beginning, was a pretty cataclysmic failure. But, you know, that happens. That happens. It is exciting, but it's also, I would say, not wanting to be curmudgeonly, horribly meaningless. You know, it's hard to describe space exploration and moon landings as soft power, as they do involve enormous thrusting rockets and so on.
Yeah, but nothing's getting blown up, at least if all goes according to plan.
Yeah, true. And again, you know, there is a benefit in spending lots of money on doing things like this, or, you know, rocket space exploration. But it is all a bit gimmicky. I mean, I think one of the focuses of their joint project is to find out exactly what time the new moon is, because, mm-hmm. of course, you know, you have the lunar calendar in Judaism, and also in the Islamic calendar as well, which symbolizes unity between the two people. Yeah, I don't buy it. It's a lot of feel good, very expensive feel good branding nonsense. And yeah, I'm going to stop being quite so cynical. But that pretty much expresses my view on it.
You don't think there's something like a little bit heartwarming in that sort of, you know, launching this thing in order to go in search of the precise definition of this shared heritage? A little bit?
I'm opening and closing my mouth like a fish.
For the benefit of our listeners, Daniela is opening and closing her mouth while maintaining a thoroughly nonplussed expression. Oscar, I mean, is there then maybe some hope, if there's clearly none there, at least the hope that the spectacle of a joint mission of this sort might cause whether you think there should be or not, an amount of rethinking of Israel among Arab populations does. I mean, I do recall, of course, that the joint space mission between the United States and the Soviet Union didn't end the Cold War. But nonetheless, does this help a bit?
I'm not sure. Also, the Emirati officers are particularly pragmatic about it. They speak of this thing purely and solely in terms of business. You know, Sara Yusif Alamiri, the Minister of State for Advanced Technology in the Emirates, said sharing knowledge and expertise is a key part of the UAE's vision to create an attractive and competitive national space industry. That's it. So, you know, there is this sort of playing to your own audiences rather than you know, creating a symbol for either the region or other spectators out there in the world. For them, this is in principle a matter of business. There is this idea within the Emirates that they have made some inroads into technology. Yes, you have some satellites designed by Emirati engineers. In fact, some had been launched. Their space program began in 2006, if memory serves me well. So there is this idea of diversifying business, which again leaves me more or less where you were.
but Daniela, is that right there what is actually underpinning the Abraham Accords from the perspective of the UAE and other Arab countries which have recently normalized diplomatic relations with Israel, that they think that, you know, it's now more productive and more useful and possibly more profitable to have Israel as a functioning ally or functioning partner rather than pretending they really care one way or the other about the Palestinians?
Well, yes, of course. But, you know, economic benefits underpin all functional and functioning peace deals as well. I mean, it's a
true enough.
Yeah, it's a pragmatic deal. I mean, our ideology doesn't really come into it. And Israel has discrete and extremely strong relations with countries that, you know, on the face of it, countries like Turkey, where there's an awful lot of antagonism. It is just annoying, though, the way that this is PR'd, the Abraham Accords and, you know, the associated projects are being PR'd as about coexistence and, you know, being brotherly and sisterly, when all the countries involved have got domestic issues with ethnic relations and democracy and human rights that really could have a lot dealt with. And certainly within Israel, it's all very well having close and warm and intercommunal relations with other Arab countries. But, you know, the situation of the Palestinians is further from being resolved than ever before. And certainly with Israeli Palestinians, again, this does not take into account anything that's going on closer to home.
Just a final thought on this subject, Oscar. How far do you think that this latest wave of normalizations between Israel and the Arab world can go? How far off are we from seeing, you know, Riyadh basically giving up on its official hostility to Israel?
Well, for all intents and purposes, if we just attend to this lack of ideology, which is an ideology in itself, you know, this idea that, you know, let us go about our pragmatic ways. Well, there you have that possibility, of course. And you could actually say, well, it pretty much already happened. But as Daniela pointed out very clearly, this has no effect for the Israeli-Palestinian on the ground. And that's where the problem is. It was never any way with the sympathies or antipathies of the other countries. And therefore, the real problem has not been solved. And in fact, we're further away from solving it the more we go on to the PR, the pragmatism of business, and so on and so forth.
Well, to return now to the United Kingdom, which has signed a new free trade deal with New Zealand, which we can all agree makes Brexit well worthwhile. But there is a genuine point of interest in the form of one of the red lines that New Zealand has drawn. Under the terms of the deal, the Kamate Haka, best known as the pre-match ritual of New Zealand's national men's rugby team, the All Blacks, will be protected from untoward appropriation, especially of the commercial variety. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle 24's resident Kiwi, David Stevens. David, first of all, perhaps for listeners from the non-rugby playing world, how would you describe the haka?
Yeah, I think interestingly there, you've used the term the haka, and actually there is no the haka. The haka would be just like saying the dance. So what we're referring to, what everyone's referring to when they refer to the haka, is actually a haka, a dance called kamate, which is a way of opening All Blacks matches, rugby matches, by the New Zealand All Blacks for over a century now. The first one was performed in 1888. It wasn't kamate. The first version of kamate was 1905. So it's been going on for quite a while now. It's basically a traditional dance. Haka just means dance. And it is used to, in fact, kamate is used to celebrate life rather than, you know, be used as any kind of war dance. That's a bit of a misinterpretation there as well.
It's an understandable misinterpretation. I think it's fair to say it is a fairly fearsome sight, the kamate in full cry, and I mean that as a compliment. But let's talk a bit about how the kamate has evolved in that time, because it hasn't always been that sort of ferocious, intimidating fanfare that we see now.
No, exactly. So I mentioned the very first haka being performed, and that was performed by what was known as the New Zealand Native Team, a name that certainly wouldn't fly these days.
Indeed not.
Yeah, kamate has been used for probably the longest portion of that time, but it's, as you say, not always been as fearsome. I think this is down to, you know, maybe not as much being maybe not as much teaching going into what was behind it. Maybe the players not quite understanding it so much, not as much reverence for what it actually meant. And that's something that's really positive since then, is the reason it has become so fearsome and maybe more appropriate is because there's been some effort put into teaching the people who are doing it why they're doing it and what the actions and the words mean.
Well, let's talk a bit about why New Zealand feels that the kamate needs protecting, because there are at large in the world in various contexts a fair few what I think we can talk about as bad hakas.
Yeah, misappropriation might be a good word. There've been a few recently. The most recent kind of awful example of this was a group of NHS nurses, I think it was last year, who decided to use it to kind of get themselves geared up for another day of fighting COVID, which it's embarrassing as a New Zealander to watch. I imagine it probably is as someone from the UK as well. Let's have a bit of a listen and see why that might be.
Yes, I mean, maximum respect and gratitude for the work they are doing and so forth, but still.
Of course. We obviously didn't see, but they're also doing some actions there. They're in headdresses, not elaborate ones. They're in face paint, all of which I don't think they've really consulted Māori on what those mean.
I rather suspect not.
On from there, maybe another example outside of the UK, Fiat, the car company, used the haka to basically sell their cars. This one was interesting, and it's interesting to note that the haka kamate that we're referring to is intended for men. It's not intended to be done by women. Women are part of hakas, but this one in particular is intended for men. So this is performed by a bunch of women on a street in Italy to try and sell a car. Let's have a listen.
Ci vuole una bella grinta per essere mamme oggi. Yes. See, I was interested to note that the Māori Party leader, Wariri Watiti, drew a distinction between what he described as appropriation and misappropriation, which, in considerable credit to him, I think is a distinction which often gets left out of discussions around cultural appropriation, that maybe misappropriation is a better word.
I would tend to agree. I think one of the things I worried about with a couple of these examples, and actually quite a lot of the examples you see of misappropriation of kamate or of any kind of haka, is that often it's used to resemble a very aggressive and a very like violent stance, and that's not what haka is, and that's not even necessarily what this haka is. And I wonder whether it kind of ends up kind of putting in people's minds this idea of Māori as kind of a primitive and savage society, which is one of those things that, you know, is a colonial kind of implant and we're trying to get rid of in the first place. So that's the worry when I hear some of these that are used in that kind of way.
Maybe let's have one more example of a bad haka.
Let's do that. I'm going to skip to another British version. It's actually a version that was released in the lead up to the Rugby World Cup here in the UK. And it's, I mean, we can just have a listen, but it's very clearly a mockery this time. So we obviously can't see it, but they're doing what could only resemble the Macarena to that. And they labelled it the Hakarena, as you would imagine they would.
I mean, you know, I am a pasty, scrawny individual who never had any great athletic ability or indeed any athletic ability at all. But I think a thing I would not do in advance of any tournament in which I was likely to come up against the All Blacks would be to make fun of the haka or make fun of this one in particular. It doesn't strike me as terrifically intelligent psychological warfare.
No, and times in the past when oppositions have tried to sort of make fun of the haka, it usually hasn't gone well for them. I think this, again, you know, the NHS workers, this version being from a provincial English rugby team, I think this is the bit that's hardest to take, and this is what this deal will hopefully try and combat, is the English in particular using this against Māori, because there's quite a long history of the English not being so nice, to put it very lightly, to Māori, and also of actively suppressing Māori language and Māori culture. So this is the sort of thing that this hopes to address, which is positive.
Well, I think it would be only appropriate then to play us out. Let's hear it done properly. And finally, on today's Daily, it's time for Henry Rhys Sheridan's regular letter from New York City.
All right, the Great Resignation, that's what some experts are calling the growing trend of workers quitting or just changing careers. The pandemic, driving a shift in work culture and what's expected at the office and beyond. In a recent study, 65% of employees say they're looking for a new job, and 88% of executives say they're seeing a higher turnover than normal.
This is not what's meant to be happening. Expanded unemployment benefits are ending, reducing people's incomes. Schools are reopening, supposedly freeing up caregivers to return to the labour force. And businesses are expanding as the most severe restrictions on their operation are lifted. So why aren't people flooding back to work? The economists can't figure it out, and it's driving them crazy. How crazy? Put it this way. I have a friend who works at a prestigious economic think tank in Midtown Manhattan. She told me that last week, one of their top economists sat down at his desk and announced that he wasn't going to get up until he'd gotten to the bottom of the Great Resignation. He began to crunch the numbers, but he couldn't get anywhere. The more numbers he crunched, the more frustrated he got. His face reddened. He began to gnash his teeth. Then, as my friend looked on, his bow tie began to slowly rotate around its central knot like a miniature propeller. The more wound up the economist became, the faster his bow tie spun. Eventually, it became a blur like a tiny helicopter blade. At this point, the bow tie was generating enough thrust to begin to propel the economist across the office in his wheelie chair. He moved slowly at first and was too absorbed in his work to notice, but he quickly picked up speed. When he realized what was happening, the economist panicked. He desperately waggled his legs around in an attempt to use his foot as a brake. But he had quite short legs, and on top of that, he'd fitted his chair with a hemorrhoid cushion that acted as a booster seat, elevating him even further from the ground. So he couldn't reach the floor with his legs for love nor money. Kicking like a toddler throwing a tantrum in a high chair, the economist shot across the think tank's office, out of the entrance, down the corridor, and into the elevator in the lobby, just as its doors were closing. My friend had to piece together what happened next through a combination of CCTV footage and eyewitness accounts. During the short elevator ride, the economist was spun around and around in the tiny space by his bow-tie propeller, bouncing off the walls until the elevator doors finally opened onto the ground floor. At that point, he was shot out of the elevator, across the building's lobby, through the revolving doors, and directly onto Fifth Avenue. The economist then rolled through the traffic down Fifth Avenue towards Lower Manhattan, picking up speed the whole time until he was out of sight. No one has seen him since. 2 days after he disappeared, a part-time kayaking instructor found his bow tie in the East River. So don't come at me saying the Great Resignation is no big deal, unless you're also willing to say it to the faces of that think tank economist's wife and children, who are looking forward to their first Christmas without Daddy. The truth is, you don't need a standing invitation to Davos to understand what's going on with the American economy. It's a story as old as the Industrial Revolution. Workers want to work fewer hours for more money under better conditions. Employers want them to work more hours for less money and under cheaper and therefore worse conditions. High savings and a collective shift in expectations has given workers an unusual amount of leverage at this moment. But, as they so often do, the employers have a trick up their sleeve.
The workforce shortage continues to be one of the biggest challenges facing the hospitality industry.
The industry is still down nearly 40,000 employees in Minnesota. To help tight staffing issues, one Twin Cities restaurant is getting creative.
It's a surprise restaurant goers weren't prepared for. A robotic server named Dee Dee.
Please take your food.
Gliding across Sawadee Thai restaurant in Minneapolis.
Enjoy.
And it comes at a...
It's not hard to see where this leads. Today, a fake waiter ferries Penang curry to your table. Tomorrow, your biological intelligence is being siphoned into the AI hive mind as part of the singularity. It's time for the workers of the world to unite. If you're ever confronted with a robot server, pick up the bowl of Masa Man it's carrying and pour the delicious peanutty sauce all over Robot Boy's mainframe until you can't tell what's smoke and what's steam. Then insist on service from a human being paid a living wage.
That was Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan in New York City, and a big shout out, as always, to his accompanying jazz trio. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Daniela Pellid and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Also, of course, to David Stevens. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi and researched by Sophie Monaghan Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.